Welcome to the Entrepreneurs in Bali podcast, where the spirit of adventure meets the passion of entrepreneurship. Nestled in the heart of Indonesia's paradise island, Bali, we bring you stories of daring individuals who have woven their dreams into the fabric of this magical place. Each episode dives into the journeys of innovators and creators who have chosen Bali not just as a backdrop, but as a vital participant in their entrepreneurial voyage. From the rice fields to the surf beaches, from digital nomads to local visionaries, join us as we uncover the challenges and triumphs of building a business in Bali. Whether you're seeking inspiration, adventure, or insights into the world of entrepreneurship in one of the most beautiful settings on earth, you found your community right here. So tune in and let's embark on this journey together. Welcome to Entrepreneurs in Bali.
Okay, welcome. This is episode number 7. And as you might hear, or if you're on YouTube, you might see, we are somewhere totally different today. It's not the studio. I thought it would be cool to have a bit of outdoor, typical Bali kind of vibe, since it's all about Bali. Mr. Benny wasn't very happy that it's so hot.
I was apprehensive, I was.
But I totally agree. I'm also a bit sweaty and there's a few mosquito, but we got the mosquito spray, so it's okay. Typical Bali, I already got some, thanks. And so yes, this is Benny. He's a very well-known guy in B-Work. Everyone likes him. And I've introduced him to Rebel, the guy that came on our very first episode. And he was very fascinated with Benny's story. I was as well. That's actually why I told Rebel about his story. So today we'll be sharing that story with you guys. It's super interesting and totally different.
This episode takes an unexpected swirl into the creamy, dreamy land of ice cream. Picture this. Daniel, our podcast hero, adores ice cream to the point of distraction. So much so that we've had to pause our riveting discussion to address his cravings. Now here's the scoop. We're not officially partnered with any ice cream artisans yet. But in a world where dreams are made of soft serve and sprinkles, we envision a future where every episode is accompanied by the melodic chime of an ice cream truck. So, to any ice cream moguls or sorbet sorcerers listening in, let's swirl up a partnership that'll make every episode a flavor-bursting experience. Share this episode with your favorite ice cream shop owner, and let's churn out some delectable collaborations. Thanks for sticking with us through this frosty diversion. Daniel, spoon in hand, is ready to dive back into the podcast. Let's give him a round of applause and maybe a napkin.
Okay, so now I'll be asking Mr. Benny lots of questions while I eat.
Cheers.
I'm kidding. Cheers.
That's okay. I'll fit in bites when I can, like now.
And yes, that's basically how I decided to get Benny on the show or the podcast, and he will be telling you all about what he's been doing, what he's doing for a living, how and why he decided to come to Bali to do that. So welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, you can go ahead and give a little spiel. That ice cream is fantastic.
Yeah,
dude. Holy crap, it's really good. What's this place called? Frostbite Bali.
Free advertisement. We're not sponsored. Not yet.
Sponsored, not yet.
We should get an ice cream sponsor. That would be cool.
That would be amazing. I mean, you can make that a thing.
Yeah.
Ice cream and podcast, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, well, I grew up in Texas. I started saying this, but Texas is hot and dry. So this heat isn't foreign, but it's much less humid in Texas. So you sweat maybe a little bit less, or at least if you sweat, it dries off quick. That's kind of a new thing to get used to. Anyways, I grew up in Texas, Dallas specifically, and I lived age 0 to 22 there. I went to university in Dallas as well, and then right in my last year of university, the pandemic hit, and I was like, okay, what do? I graduated and did the whole remote graduation, no ceremony until a year and a half later, actually. Weird time. And eventually I ended up moving later in 2020 to Washington, D.C. I followed my ex-girlfriend there, and she'll come in later in the story. And I moved to D.C. and I started working remotely. I worked for a year at a semiconductor manufacturing firm, which is interesting. That product is, I mean, semiconductors run the world, so there's a lot of interesting things to learn there. If anybody's technical, I was a program manager, so I sold power amplifiers, for blanking filters, whatever, different kinds of products, low noise amplifiers, whatever it is. Basically anything that fits into the chain of products you use in large scale systems, usually with applications for satellite communications, electronic warfare even, a lot of interesting stuff. And this company sold into a lot of defense contractors. So you're interacting with the, I was interacting a lot with, you know, the infamous military industrial complex that is pretty big in the US. It was interesting to work there for some time, but the problem was that I was kind of like a cog in a big machine, very big company. I wasn't super happy with the career progression that I was seeing there, and I wasn't excited by the work, and it felt kind of like a stopgap before I figured out what would come next. Mm-hmm. Especially since the original plan before the pandemic hit was to travel the world for a year, follow my older brother's footsteps. He did it right after graduating university as well. And that didn't happen because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So I had to scramble, find this job, and then, yeah, kind of wanted to still pursue that dream of seeing the world, especially coming to Asia. That's also going to come in later. So yeah, I actually graduated with a degree in physics, and the semiconductor manufacturing firm was the closest I ever got to using that degree. Yeah. Because I quickly kind of moved away from it. I started a startup in college. It didn't work out, but it was like a very fun experience. I can get into that in detail maybe if we want.
Yes, of course.
But yeah, that, I loved working on that startup. I love making it. I want to take another bite out of this because you're eating over there and it's making me hungry.
I've heard it so many times about like people studying something and then the path that actually plays out is just so much different. But I do believe studying is still good in the sense of like you activate your brain in that, like you're forcing your brain to learn more.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, yeah. Which a lot of people after school, they just sit back. I didn't study. I wanted to, but I didn't get in. I wanted to do architecture. But unfortunately, even though I believe my grades was good enough in South Africa, I just didn't get in. Not gonna name my reason why I think that was the case, but anyway. Mm. But yeah, today I'm actually glad it didn't work out because I probably would have sat in the office today if it worked out, and I would have been drawing houses for the rest of my life, even though it's something I loved and still love to do.
Architecture.
Yeah, but I do like what I do now a lot more. So
it seems like that's the case, yeah. Mm. Well, listen, I think with this stuff, there's no real answer. Maybe you would have been really happy in that career as well, but I've took you in this direction, and it sounds like you did more than make the best of it. You found what you want to do. Mm. What you said about people not usually following their degrees, this is super true. And I'd actually be curious to know how that maps between like the U.S. and other countries. Like, are Americans less likely to use their degrees than other countries? If I had to guess, that would be true, but... Yeah, it'd be interesting to see.
I don't know about other countries, but I do know in South Africa, like, there's so many people that study something, and then after they finish, they just can't get a job in that direction as well. Like, it's a flooded, for example, I know probably like 10% of my matric, like my final year of school, I think about 10% of the kids in class went to do BCom.
Which one?
BCom. I'm not sure what that is in English, but it's like accounting, basically.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Not a lot, but I think the majority of the people if there's one thing that was more populated.
Plurality.
Yeah. I think that was it. And I think a lot of them, once they get out, there's just so many people in the whole country doing that. What exactly are they going to do?
Yeah. It's a supply problem, right? Definitely. They have too much supply, not enough demand kind of thing. So... I think that happens a lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting that South Africa has this specific problem with accounting of all things. That's too.
Just an example though. I know like nursing is also a lot of people done that, but I saw a lot of them did get jobs, but I do think that they struggled to get a job. It's not so easy.
Nursing specifically. That's in the US, the common one I hear is liberal arts based degrees. History, English, literature, that kind of stuff. Yeah. Those jobs people have trouble sometimes finding a career. But yeah, it sounds like it depends per country. That's really interesting. I studied physics, which I was decently happy with that choice. I mean, physics, and you kind of alluded to this earlier, you said, you know, university maybe teaches you how to think a little bit and it gives you structure. Physics was my way of trying to figure out how to think super logically, analytically, how to figure out how to solve through difficult problems. That was the theory, at least. In retrospect, I wish I had done computer science, foreshadowing a little bit. because I think that would have taught me like a much more applicable hard skill. With physics, really, if you want to make physics your career, you don't have too many options.
Yeah.
The biggest ones being like go into academia, PhD, you know, work in a lab, whatever, or work in a, like a professional lab, maybe working for the US government, JPL, there's a lot of different programs there. Or like take the physics degree and then do a master's in some engineering based thing and then go work as an engineer. Like hard, like just physics, theoretical physics. It's hard sometimes to find a career. And I never intended to be honest. I studied it, wanted to learn how to think, do something that sounds impressive, and then go into the business world probably. So that's basically what I did. 1 year at the program manager, as a program manager at the semiconductor manufacturing firm. And then I was, you know, attracted to startup culture and enjoyed building the startup that I did. So I was like, okay, time to go find one. And I applied to, oh man, I remember 150 different companies.
Yes.
And I interviewed for 17.
Sure.
And then I got two offers in the same week.
Yeah.
And I decided between the two, and I ultimately went with the earlier stage, smaller startup, which was a Series A insurance technology startup, which is cool. And so I went to work for them as a business operations guy, which basically meant everything that didn't have to do with building or selling the product.
Sure.
So HR, legal, compliance, people acquisition, talent operations, whatever it is. And I was excited by this because I wanted to, because I was attracted to startups, I wanted to build stuff. I just wanted to create, you know, like build processes that are going to scale with the company to 500 employees, 1,000 employees, 2,000, whatever. And that'd be cool. When I joined the job, it was about a month of building processes, and then very quickly it became, we need this like compliance certification, everybody else is busy, you're the guy, so execute, get us this compliance certification. And there was a lot of learning in that, and that was good. And then it just became very like monotonous, routine, compliance-based stuff, and not to fault anybody in the compliance space, but it is not for me. Basically, it involves like some auditor, a third party, comes to the company, and they peruse through the entire company, the HR data, the engineering data, access rights, everything like this, and then investigate it, and then you give them all this data, and they say, okay, you have good data management practices, you get the certification, or they say, try again. That was a kind of the, and that's the procedure, and that's important, and it helped the company, and it was needle moving, but it just wasn't, exciting by any means. I just felt like kind of dead-ended, stuck in the job. I was like, I'm in the startup world and I hate it, you know? Like, what do I do with my life? What do I do with my career?
Sure.
So I had this kind of existential crisis. At the same time, my ex was having her own existential crisis. She was working in lobbying in D.C. Lobbying in D.C. is a crazy world. I'm not going to say too much about it, but there was like some crazy stuff happening at her workplace and all this stuff. So she was ready to leave as well. And we up and went. We tried to figure out where to go. She wanted to go to art school. We started picking art schools. Ended up at Barcelona.
Nice.
And moved to Barcelona, spent 3 months there. I was burnt out and couldn't motivate myself to start on the next career thing, which is what I'm doing now. And the goal was to quit, move to Barcelona, and then start self-teaching software development and then see if I can build my own startup or my own products that maybe later can become startups. You can build companies around them. So yeah, moved to Barcelona, my ex and I break up, and I'm like, okay, I got nowhere to be, I got no career, I just threw, you know, quit my job and big gamble, what do I do? And I went home for the holidays, it was the end of 2022, and I went to stay with my older brother, who was just wrapping up his PhD, and we were watching like YouTube videos at like midnight or 1 a.m. or something, we both got sick with COVID, so we're miserable, we're sick, we're watching YouTube. And he puts on some random like hour-long documentary of a guy, a Russian guy, like touring Bali and you know, making his own like YouTube documentary.
That's cool.
And we watched the whole thing. And at the end of it, I remember my brother turns to me and he goes, so what do you think of Bali? I was like, oh, yeah, it looks pretty cool. Very green, a lot of temples. That's cool. He's like, yeah, I think you should go there. I was like, what do you mean? He's like, I think you should buy a ticket to one way to go there tonight.
Nice.
So I cannot do that. Yes. But the next day, sick, coughing over my laptop, I bought a one-way ticket and went to Bali 2 months later. This was beginning of February, beginning of 2023. So I ended up in Bali. February 9th was the day that I arrived here. I remember that, in 2023.
How were they with COVID? Because you said you had COVID.
COVID I got over about a month and a half before that, thankfully.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there was some time in between. I bought the one-way ticket like end of December and then flew like
beginning of February. Yeah, so there's some time in between. I wrapped up stuff in the US, went to Europe, picked up my stuff from Barcelona, moved it to friends, and then from Europe flew to Bali. That was kind of that.
And since you got to Bali, what did you start to do then?
Well, I was like ready to hit the ground running because, you know, at this point I had been out of a job and for like 6 to 8 months. And the US, like the way Americans tend to think about career, it's really hard to break out of this kind of mindset where it's like, if you have a gap in your career, you're like wasting your life, you're wasting your time, you know, like you're not working on your career. What are you doing? And I was in that mindset, and it's I spent, you know, the last year and a half, 2 years trying to break out of it a little bit. But at this point, I didn't have a job. I was living off my savings. Thankfully, American US dollars go far outside of the US. I think it's like the, especially here. It's such a privilege that I have, that, and all Americans have, that I think it's so under-realized that the dollar is worth ridiculously. It's just such a strong currency abroad that we have like a very specific privilege to be able to spend it. And so I had these savings. These savings were going to last me 3-4 years at least if I spent them in Asia based on the runway calculations I had done. And so I had time, but I was, you know, purposeless and unfulfilled and whatever. And I just couldn't, I still, this burnout that I felt in Barcelona, I still had it when I came here. So I was like, first I tried to trick myself or like, you know, try to do both, like relax and enjoy Bali, but also learn to code. And there was just a lot of conflict there. And I burnt myself out from that too. It was like not finding a good balance. And so eventually I just kind of gave into it. And from February to July, you know, I kind of didn't do much coding, just enjoyed Bali. I ran a marathon. That was that was a good little checkpoint goal that I had for myself to prove to myself that more so to just like base my experience in Bali around.
A marathon,
No, in Singapore.
I wanted to say, you'll be boiling.
Honestly, it was worse. In Bali. I agree, but it was actually worse than it would have been here in Singapore.
Why? Is it even hotter there?
So hot, yeah. Sure. The marathon, it was a midnight marathon, kind of like a special one. So you even though it's supposedly better, you ran it, it started at midnight. And it was, I remember, 34 degrees Celsius, which was, I can't remember, in Fahrenheit, probably like 94 degrees Fahrenheit, like 80%, 85% humidity at midnight. And I ran a marathon in that weather. Dude, it was the hardest physical thing I have ever done in my life. It was so hard.
How long? Like 40-something?
It's 42-kilometer race. Yeah. Never. My time was okay. I undertrained for it. I'm still like the effects of that. I'm still dealing with. I injured my hamstrings, pulled them, and now it's like a recurring injury. But I ran it in like 5 hours with that weather, which I think was decent first marathon. You know, severely undertrained. I did like 20% of the training that I should have done. I was also traveling and trying to balance that. Anyways, but it was a nice experience. And I'm glad that I did it, and it was like very rewarding emotionally too. And then after that, I was completely burned out, physically, mentally, everything. So I took the next 2 months after that to just chill. I just partied. I hung out with friends. I traveled. I went to massages. I did spa, like whatever I wanted, just for 2 months. What a gift that time was, you know? And then I got tired of it. I was like, this is enough. I need to do something. I want to create. I want to build. That feeling came back. In July 2023, I started coding. I started self-teaching myself seriously. And by November, so at the same time, I started blogging about my progress. I posted a link on my Instagram, and a friend, you know, acquaintance from university, started following along. In November, he reached out to me kind of randomly. He's like, hey, you seem to be making good progress. I'm a freelance software consultant. I've got some clients. They need some junior developers on there. Do you want to join? And he's like, part-time, async, fully remote. So yeah, this is great. It's perfect. He was super considerate. He knew I was in Bali. He was like, this could work with how you're doing things. He's like, this is very kind of you. And I took the opportunity, started working for him. So 4 months after learning the code, I started making money off of coding, which is great.
That's great. And how many hours a day were you putting in to learn in that 4 months?
I had to learn how to work again. So in the beginning, it was probably 2 to 4 hours. And that's, I would say, like, you know, with this kind of pattern, it's kind of made it, this being like a slow sine wave looking, but gradual positive slope. I think it's gotten up to now I'm working 6 hours deep work kind of almost every day, which is a lot of coding. Anybody in a career that requires like full focus during the task, like writing, video editing, I feel like falls under that, speaking, coding, doing 6 hours of that per day is yeah. energy taxing, but it's exactly what I wanted, and I'm enjoying it quite a bit.
Nice. So if there's someone watching that would want to enter the coding thing, do yeah. you say it will take them 4 months as well, or do you think it will take them a bit more since you had the contact and they, let's assume they don't have that contact. If they put in 2 to 4 hours a day of learning, teaching themselves how to code,
yeah.
do you think it will take them 4 months before they can get
good
a job in that point, in that direction or not?
No, that's a good question. Yeah, so I got lucky, for sure. Maybe I made my own luck a little bit by blogging in public, but yeah, I didn't know that this was gonna, that guy had some of these opportunities, all these things. It fell into my lap, I didn't do any outreach. So, yeah, let's say that you can do additional cold outreach without sacrificing your coding time, say you have that extra time or energy, then I could see it totally being possible. Yeah, I mean, go ahead.
I do believe that as you unintentionally did with like your personal brand, like you were not advertising, but you were showcasing that you are doing this, that has a massive impact on any individual or business. That's why I'm also like going full steam ahead on my personal brand to then like amplify all the things that I'm doing as well. Because that all builds like traffic in any direction, from the podcast to the short form, whether they're coming from podcast to short form or from short form to podcast or YouTube or wherever it might be. Like personal brand is a very strong thing that one can do.
And it's a good connector.
Sounds like you did it unintentionally.
Half intentionally, and it worked out. I would say. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're 100% right. The phrase that I've heard attached to what I did is learning in public.
Yeah.
Which is hard. Yeah. It's a little scary at first because you're basically publicly broadcasting, hey, this is what I'm bad at, and this is what I'm going to try to get better at, and this is how fast it's going to take me, you know? You're basically like, you have to be comfortable with showing your learning speed or like, you know, showing what you don't know. And that was an uncomfortable feeling for me. Maybe I have a big ego, but it was hard to show for a bit. But yeah, I think there's a lot of benefits to showing and building and learning all kind of in public. It takes a little bit of extra effort, extra time. But I could totally envision, like, let's say I keep creating content down the line and maybe I want to start a business and I have a good online brand presence. Maybe I can use the business to, or I can use my brand presence to advertise the business and vice versa. There's a reason that businesses do influencer marketing, all these things. I think you're exactly right. Like it's a flywheel, kind of feeds into it. Which is good into itself.
So now obviously you're still doing that. Do you plan on doing that forever, or do you plan on like focusing on something else soon?
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing a lot of freelancing on the side, but that is a means to an end for sure.
So like
that,
it's paying the bills.
It's paying the bills.
You mentioned, and this is where the big excitement for me and for Revel and everyone came in, is the little, I don't know, like, don't want to call it a game because, I guess it's not really a game. It's, as you said, a web app. So can you tell the viewers a bit more of that? I already know the basics, but tell them more mainly.
Yeah. Happy to.
What is it all about?
The little web app I'm building.
Yeah.
This is a project for learning.
Okay.
I don't anticipate that it's going to make me much money, although there are maybe monetization opportunities, but the app is a web app where you can get a bunch of unique chess insights about your own games. So I built this chess analysis engine that pulls in a bunch of games. First, I did this like big analysis on 15 million games to get like a bunch of goofy insights, completely like full silliness. Some could be useful, but for the most part, that wasn't the intention. Things like which piece has the best kill-death ratio, or which one on average moves across the board the most, or how many times a knight hops over another piece, like all this kind of weird shit. Can I cuss? Is that allowed? Can I say shit?
Yeah, that's fine.
And so I thought, okay, I did this big analysis. It would be cool if you could do this on your own games. So I created this site where I pull in your games, I run the analysis on them, and I give you the insights. And this could just be like a fun little comparison game where you can pull in the insights of the best chess players in the world and then have a leaderboard where people compete to see which pieces, you know, have the best kill death ratio. And this is feasibly something I would be curious. I haven't run this analysis yet, but I think this is something that you could feasibly beat one of the best players in the world in some of these stats, like kill death ratio.
Yeah.
I don't think the best players in the world are like indexing or playing in a way that they're trying to get their king to have the best kill death ratio. That's not a thing. So yeah, it could just be kind of like a fun comparison thing. And it's also could get some useful insights out of it. Let's say like I run an analysis on your on all the openings that you use, and then I sort them by the white to black win ratio, which basically if the ratio is higher, that means the opening tends to win more when white is playing it. And when it's lower, the opening is more effective for black, basically.
And is this online, like playing only online or physically in person as well? Because that must be difficult to get it, because it has to like be a camera that picks up exactly what it is. And that's
there are chessboards that do this, like track digitally and then convert it into what's called PGN, which is basically it's portable game notation. It's the way that chess is most often communicated by just by text. So like you can communicate a whole game just by this format. And that's actually the data format that I'm parsing through. So when I pull in your games from chess.com, it spits out a bunch of PGN for one PGN for every single game. And then I parse through the PGN and run a bunch of functions that I built to get the analysis insights from.
Nice. And then you also mentioned once that like you're busy with a thing where they will be, or at least I think you said you were planning on doing or something. I can't remember.
Mm.
You mentioned that there will be like comments, for example, like a voice saying, "Oh, I wouldn't have done that," or something like that.
Yes. And this is the next thing I want to work on. Once this app is finished and it's close, I just need to build out a few more features, and I'm being a little bit perfectionist about it. But the next thing I want to work on, probably the last thing in the chess space that I'll work on for a while, this idea I had with the help from brainstorming with a couple of people at BeWork, at our co-working space, it's to basically create like an automated chess commentary bot. And this can be expanded on just beyond chess as well, but the idea would be take the chess games, put them through the analysis engine that I built, get a bunch of the insights, give the insights to an AI model, say, generate a funny script for me, then take that script, pull in some kind of text-to-speech, you know, API. Yeah. There's all these interesting ones. They've like cloned Morgan Freeman's voice and David Attenborough and a bunch of famous people, and then have one of those famous AI voices narrate the script, create a few visuals with maybe like a chessboard and that shows the chess pieces as they move across the board while the narration script is going, and then there you go. Upload to TikTok, you have automated chess commentary video content. Which is freaking cool. Yeah.
It would be nice if you can also do it live, like as you are playing.
Definitely.
Online chess.
Definitely could do that.
Chess.com.
I think all of that would feed. That's another thing you could do is like, when people go to their results page on my web app, automatically at the top is I've already created their, you know, a video of their most recent game, and maybe I create one and if they want some more, they can pay me like $3 and get, 20 more, share it on their social media channels, whatever. And there's a lot of cool things. But I like the live narration idea as well. And that one, once the first thing is built, it wouldn't be hard to take the second half of that and just like, build a way to watch for the data as it comes in, and then immediately push that to the narration script.
Is that your plan of monetizing it as well, to let them like pay for getting the videos then?
I think that's probably the most monetizable thing. Another thing could be, as you build out more analysis insights, some of them are paywalled, depending on their usefulness or how funny they are. But
like if they want Morgan Freeman to say it, they have to pay.
Exactly. You could do like certain voices or paywall. That's totally doable.
I think a subscription model would be best. Like
be cool.
You said like $3 for 10 extra videos, but I think if they just pay like $27 or $29 a month, like I think some of those like super chess focused influencers or whatever, they would actually pay $50 a month just to be able to, in a click of a button, have like
get
10
their games.
Videos. Yeah.
That is actually a really good point. And when I was thinking about like generalizing this tool, that it could be really interesting to create a tool where you can create automated highlights for like almost anything. Let's say baseball highlights or sports highlights or any other kind of sports. I say baseball and sports, baseball being one of the sports. Yeah, so there's a lot of opportunity to create content, and then maybe I could charge people to be able to do that, especially like if an influencer wants to create content over their own chess stuff. Let's say a Twitch streamer has a bunch of chess content. Yeah, automatically take the games and create something unique. Yeah. There's definitely...
It'll save them a cool lot of time. There. Or at least if they have a photo, like a video editor, they don't have to pay the video editor to do the work anymore. Now it's $50 a month and it's a fraction of the cost that they would have spent.
True.
Probably would have spent $300 to pay to get 10 shorts made out of a long form video.
Yeah, and there are some tools I think that already do this where they take a long form and they break it down into short, like Opus. CapCut I think does that already too.
And I tried it for the podcast itself, the videos. The shorts is okay. The section that it chooses is good, but I feel like the editing should be better. The editing is very like robotic and just looks, it's not eye-catchy enough.
Yeah.
It's those small kind of things in short form that is super important. You can't just have an average edit.
For sure.
Like putting in half an hour extra on the editing will double the like the view rate and the all of like the impact that short will have.
Yeah, true. So, worth spending the extra time to get it right.
Yeah. So I feel like those kind of tools, it's a good start. It has, I guess, technology has to start somewhere, but it's not to the point where I will use it constantly. I still
edit
it myself.
I hear you. So. One thing that I was thinking, that some of these tools that already exist don't do very well, if they don't allow people who are more serious to use it as like a starting point. It would be super cool if like they generated like a DaVinci Resolve file or a CapCut file or something that you could then pour it into and then make modifications to. But yeah, hard to say how to get it right.
Yeah, definitely. I think that it's definitely this platform, you have it and you said that you are thinking of monetizing it, but I think it's, since you have it, you might as well just monetize it.
See if I can.
Yeah. Definitely think you should, because like, I understand it wasn't a waste of your time because that was your way of learning how to code, but still, if you have it, why not just make use of it? And I do believe that there is a lot of people that will make use of it and like the idea.
I hope so. I hope so.
Which, by the way, can grow as well. Like, you can get more ideas for it or whatever.
True. So. Yeah, I mean, one of the best ways, by the way, to learn to code is 100% project based. Like, just build something that's interesting to you, and then you learn what you need to learn along the way. And build it in a way, you do a little bit of research and figure out what like a good tech stack is to build in, and then go and build, you know, and learn that tech stack and figure it out. And this was my way of doing that. That's definitely an important thing to share. Oh, and you were talking about how do you find kind of new ideas? And yeah, if you start monetizing, then you start to get user feedback and you start to figure out what people want and what they need. And then that might open the door to another idea that you could, you know, blow up into something new. So I haven't experienced that yet myself, because I haven't, you know, launched this thing, but I'm curious.
Yeah. Do you use AI to help you with the coding?
All the time. Best teacher.
Really?
100%.
Do you ask it physically to give you code, or do you ask it to teach you, like, how to
both.
Do this?
All of it. Okay. All of it. Yeah.
Just the other day I tried, can't say boredom, because I definitely wasn't bored, but for some reason I just got the idea and I wanted to do it. So I went on ChatGPT and I asked the, I guess I'm going to call it a lady. I asked her how to, or like to give me code for a little game, almost like that, the dinosaur that Google had that jumps over the...
On the loading page.
And the rocks. So I was thinking of, on my website where I have all my links, I wanted to have something similar. So I was thinking, okay, let's make like $100 note, which is like blowing in the air, like Flappy Bird, where you have to tap to raise or let it fall down and then tap to go up again, and then there's like my business, the Elite logo coming, and then there's 100 plus,
that's
like avoid
awesome.
Avoid that or things like that.
Yeah.
And I asked ChatGPT to do that, and then I like linked the photos, like I've created $100 like my face on it, and like a lot
that's
of
amazing
funny things. But for some reason, it just didn't work, because the one moment it's like, okay, now it's jumping, but it's jumping like too high. And then the next moment it's like not enough. And then I try and change it. And obviously, I have no idea with coding. My coding is like 0.1% knowledge. So there's next to nothing. Yeah. And so I was just relying on ChatGPT. And then every time I'm like, okay, now that is done. Now add this, like add obstacles. So I wanted to build on the idea, but it just couldn't get it to the point where it was like functioning. So at the later stage, I just gave up.
Yeah, I think the experience you had is probably a common one.
Yeah.
And it was my experience too in the beginning, because, you know, when you're learning to code, the first question a lot of people say now is like, oh, isn't ChatGPT replacing, and isn't it going to take care of it? It's not there yet.
No.
Not there yet. Not. And I remember at the beginning, I would try to get it to just like write my code for me, do this. And then eventually, like, you realize, okay, it can't do the big blocks of code. No. So let's break it down, do this thing. And then it makes mistakes there. And you have to figure out, okay, how do I make sure that this, and then eventually you get it right. And how do I make sure that this section fits in with this new section that I needed to build for me? And that's kind of the way that it goes. Yeah. And
that's where I couldn't, because that's the little bit of manual work that I didn't know how to do.
You have to understand the code at some point. Yeah.
Enough of it at least. It suggested that I break it up into sections, but then I'm like, okay, but if you're going to give me three sections, I'm not going to know where to put the three sections, because I know there's like the body that it needs to be in, and if it's not in the right place, it's just going to...
Something's wrong.
It's not going to work. Yeah, it's just too much.
There are better tools than the vanilla ChatGPT experience, which I assume you just like OpenAI ChatGPT.
ChatGPT 4.
Yeah. Oh, 4 is good. Yeah. But the tool that I use integrates GPT into the coding editor. And so you can give it your codes within the code base where you write the code to have it review in context of the code around it, which is nice. So it does a better job of piecing things together. Nice. But even then, like I've spent many days at this point where the whole day it's just back and forth with ChatGPT. No, not this. Teach me how to do this. And eventually what happens often is I'm just being lazy and I'm not like actually trying to understand the code. And once I understand it, I can see where the communication is going wrong. Yeah. You have to communicate with it properly too, right? There's a whole field of prompt engineering that's popped up just so you can figure out how to communicate to ChatGPT. To get it to do the things that you want it to do. And so there are communication errors or miscommunications between you and ChatGPT. And to get past those, you need to really understand what it's given you and why it's wrong. Mm. And so, many times I've gone back and forth with ChatGPT, and you just have to kind of push it in the direction that you want it to go. But as far as like teaching, it's amazing. Yeah. Like it gets you to understanding the problem really fast.
Okay.
A lot faster than I think it used to be.
Yeah.
Like before, what you do is, and this is what all coders pretty much do, you go to Google, you search the error, you find someone who's had a similar error in a similar context. That all takes time, right, to find the right thing. Then you see what solutions happen to work for them, if you can find it. If you can't, good luck, you're going to go down a rabbit hole.
Sure.
Now with GPT, that whole process is pretty much automated, right, because it's ingested Stack Overflow or like a question and ask forum for coders. Ingested a lot of these Google results, and they can parse through that more efficiently than you can, which is why it's helping. But as far as like getting creative and linking together problems and understanding more deeply sometimes where the problem is, it's not good at. But it's writing syntax errors, which is just like you forgot a period here or a comma here, it's really good at catching those.
Sure.
So it helps with like a lot of simple mistakes that otherwise would take you a long time to find, because human eye isn't trained for this.
Yeah.
That's why it's helpful.
So if someone wanted to start coding, where do you say it's the best way for them to learn? Should they like get an online course, or should they just go on YouTube, or just ChatGPT, or like a combination of them all, or what do you suggest?
The latter, yeah. Okay. I can kind of explain some of the learnings that I've gone through. First things first, courses. I'll talk about courses. Courses are useful at the very start, and when you are exploring an entirely new field. Okay. Let's say like you already know how to code and you want to get into machine learning, go take a machine learning course, learn what you don't know, and then go, now that you know what you don't know, go learn those things, you know? Same thing with coding. When you're just starting out, you don't even know what you don't know, right?
Yeah.
So you need some structure, you need a guide. Okay, now you're going to learn the fundamentals, learn data structures, you learn loops and if statements and how to piece those things together. Pick an easy language. Python is the second or first most popular language, and it's got amazing documentation and it's easy to read. It's very human readable. So that's usually the go-to I would recommend. And then, okay, now you know what you don't know. Now go build something. And that's where ChatGPT really starts to come into play. And you can use ChatGPT during the course phase too, just to like, one, it can tell you also what you don't know, but like from a very high level usually. But two, it can just reinforce concepts. Like I plenty of times I would take a course and the teacher, you know, didn't explain it the way that well, or maybe I didn't understand it very well. Go to ChatGPT, ask for another explanation. It gives you a complicated one. You say, LE5, do you know what this is? The Reddit thing? Explain it like I'm five. It'll explain it like it's five. It'll give you like pie and cooking analogies. Yes. It's great. So it's really, it's a great teacher for things that are commonly seen on the internet that it's been trained on. But then projects is like the next step. And most people wait too long to get into project work. They think that they're not ready. They get intimidated, which is fair. But all you're doing with a project is you take a big, big problem and you break it down and solve the smaller pieces. And you keep breaking it down until you have solvable and solved problems. Mm-hmm. So if you're building a web app has front end and back end. Do you need to store user data? Figure out how to connect a database. How do you deploy it to the web? Learn the deployment stuff. What tools can you use? How do you build this like a form with a submit button? Well, first learn how to build the submit button, then learn how to, you know what I mean? Like you just kind of keep breaking it down and then it's quite doable. That would be my recommendation. I took one course, a 100-day Python course. Yes. I got through it in 30 days.
Yes.
That's all I was doing.
Yeah.
I got bored very quickly throughout the course, but I decided I'd finish it. I probably could have stepped away from it halfway through, but then I built my first project, this like super simple web app that told you if you should read the news today or not, based on your tolerance of negative news and how much negative news there was and a given selection of news that I was automatically pulling in every day. And then that was like no front end, super simple, like just a couple buttons and a couple things changing. Yeah. But it worked, and I was super exciting. And I was like, okay, now let's do a big jump. And then I went to the chess project, and that's been the main.
How long have you been on that now?
Chess project. I started doing it at the beginning of October 2023. I coded October and November on it. I took November and December to travel Europe, and that put basically all coding on pause. And then came back. Wrapped it up January, started the web app end of January, worked on that February and March, along with scaling up more freelancing. And yeah, a lot of learning there, a lot of learning for me, for a new tech stack. It's called Next.js, React is what I'm using. How to build a full stack web app that's pretty and use not buggy and user friendly and does all these different things. And just a lot of learning. And so it's taking a long time, but there's been good progress there.
Yeah. I must say it looks very interesting. Like my first time when I stepped into Bwork and I saw not just you but a few people and it's just like code on the screen, I'm like, oof.
A lot of coders there.
Yeah, I have no idea what's going on there, but it looks so fascinating. And
dude, you could totally do it. I'm not special. I don't think I'm particularly smart, but if you just are consistent with something, consistency is key. Yeah. It really helps. Yeah, and if you learn it properly with the tools nowadays, like it could be
definitely easier now compared to when Mark Zuckerberg was coding Facebook.
For sure.
Just imagine he must have had it. Wish he had ChatGPT to ask how to add
night and day
function, whether the people are single or in a relationship.
Exactly. All
those kind of things. So that's very interesting. But I just don't have time.
Yeah, you're busy.
I wish I had time, because it is something that I'm interested in. When I like the software company, I was looking into coding, but I did a bit on the front end, and then when it started at the back end, I'm like, shit, it's like way too much, and I saw the learning curve is going to take me forever, so I decided to rather outsource it.
I hear you. Yeah,
just to speed up the process, because otherwise and I was still doing a full-time job as well, so it would have been impossible for me to do that. So yes,
well, 6 months, dude, is plenty to get into. If you just, you know, 2 to 4 hours per day, you know how to code.
So there you guys go, no excuses. 6 months and you can quit your job and start coding as a freelancer and come to Bali.
I think so.
Meet us at Bwork and say, hey, I saw the podcast. I decided to start coding.
That would be sick. You gotta come.
Yeah, so cool. I think we wrap it up. Thank you for watching. Where can they reach you if they want to connect with you on Instagram or LinkedIn, wherever? Where do you prefer?
I need to figure out my preferences with this stuff, but I think a good starting point and where there will be updates and links and all this stuff is my website. So BennyRubinov.com.
We'll leave the link in the description.
Perfect. It's perfect.
As well. So
cool. Cool. Thank you for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Daniel. While he fetches that, I could tell dad jokes, do something funny, so that Daniel can watch this back later and decide what to keep. That's what I'm gonna do. I have a collection. These are really bad. Why do British people say water? Because they drink the tea.